Religions, moral, serious, feudal, general, restricted, enormous, or diminutive. The Americans make associations to give entertainments, to found seminaries, to build inns, to construct churches, to diffuse books, to send missionaries, and in this manner they found hospitals, prisons, and schools. If it's proposed to inculcate some truth or to foster some feeling by which the encouragement of a great example, they form a society. Wherever at the head of some new undertaking you see the government in France or a man of rank in England, in the United States you will find, you're sure to find, an association. Today, throughout the world, there is a similar profusion of associations. And they have arisen in contrast to the nation state. These are often referred to as non-governmental associations, and they also conduct activities large and small throughout the world. There's been a tremendous growth in the number and the influence of non-governmental associations over the last few decades. However, perhaps because of American enthusiasm for such associations, or because of the narrowness of their objectives, these organizations are sometimes resented and limited in various nation states, often being considered instruments of Western influence. In the United States itself, these kinds of organizations are sometimes disparaged as special interests or lobbying organizations. I always remember one of the graduates of this law school, Lou Kramer, had just finished a very prestigious appointment in Washington, D.C., and I had just moved to Washington, and I was asking him what he was doing, and he described his work, and as a naive young person, I said, well, that sounds like a lobbyist, and he said, well, yes, I guess I am a lobbyist, and that began my introduction to the value and importance of lobbyists and non-governmental organizations in general. So today, our discussion will focus on the impact and effectiveness of non-governmental organizations and their important role in religious freedom. Now, in addition to non-governmental organizations, we have the influence of international institutions of various kind, including the United Nations and others of great stature, which have also grown in increasing importance in coordinating, motivating, restricting, and sometimes punishing nation states. As these international organizations have grown in power and prestige, they too have spawned a plethora of non-governmental organizations which are intent on informing the objectives and the priorities of these international organizations. So as we talk about our theme of connecting communities of discourse, this session today is really about how those international organizations, the non-governmental organizations, have a practical impact. As one of my professors used to use in an auto racing metaphor, this is where the rubber meets the road. So this is where the ideas are shaped. We are privileged to have three distinguished panelists today who will help elucidate these ideas. We're going to follow the order outlined in the program. To my right is Dr. John Taylor. He studied and taught at Cambridge and at the University of Birmingham in England. He taught Islamic studies, and he has been a director of the World Council of Churches and was involved with the dialogue with people of living faiths and ideologies. He is currently the Secretary General of the World Conference on Religion and Peace, and presently represents the International Association for Religious Freedom at the United Nations Geneva location. We're grateful to have him with us and look forward to his comments. He will then be followed by Paulo Torto Ortega, who is the Director General of Religious Associations from Mexico. He has studied and taught sociology, social sciences, and is involved with the, as the secretary or the director general of religious associations. He works directly under the Secretariat of Government, which is akin to the Ministry of Interior for many nations. It is responsible for social harmony, social peace, development, and welfare in Mexico. We're grateful and privileged to have him with us. And then we will be pleased to hear from Dr. Tasir Mohamed Mandour from Egypt, who's a professor and department head at the Faculty of Medicine at Al-Azhar. University, and its only female member. She's been involved in numerous items relating to religious dialogue and is the on the Committee for Islamic Relations in the Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs. She mentioned to me earlier that her first name, Tazir, means to make things easy. So we hope that will be our privilege today. So we'll turn the microphone over to Dr. Taylor.
Good morning, dear friends. I want to address a particular example of cooperation today, and a particular example of connecting communities of discourse. And I want to give you some information about what may be new to some of you, an initiative for a United Nations decade for interreligious and intercultural dialogue, understanding, and cooperation for peace. I start by expressing my deep gratitude and admiration for the contribution of these international law and religion symposia at Brigham Young University, and in particular, the inspiring leadership and guidance of Professor Cole Durham Jr. Among his many contributions, he gave invaluable help to my own 110-year-old non-governmental organization, which, drawing people from all the faiths of the world, was evolving, and is still evolving, a code of ethics for religious responsibilities to protect and implement the fundamental right for freedom of religion or belief. We can't have rights without responsibilities. Now, in addressing the challenge of this symposium to connect, I understand E.M. Forster's famous injunction, "Only connect," to mean that cooperation is essential rather than just simple and easy. The dialogue must be intentional and productive, and not just automatic or decorative. There have been too many expressions of goodwill and even solemn conventions of mutual protection which have remained dead letters. There have been too many declarations, even the 1981 United Nations Declaration on the Elimination of All Forms of Intolerance and Discrimination Based on Religion or Belief, which have received lip service by governments and by society and have not been implemented. Now, at the 20th anniversary of that famous 1981 Declaration of the United Nations, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Freedom of Religion or Belief, together with the government of Spain, held an international consultation on religious education in schools as a preventive measure to combat intolerance and discrimination. And NGOs, such as the one that I served, helped in the preparation and the follow-up of that conference. For example, we had regional meetings on four continents to promote interfaith learning and respect. We've been encouraged as NGOs based in Geneva and based in New York to strengthen our cooperation in committees made up of the different organizations. And we've taken up practical measures, education for tolerance in the context of human rights education, truthful, respectful approaches to education about world's religions. We followed up the special rapporteur's study on the role of religions and cultures on the status of women, sometimes good, but sometimes very bad. And we've tried to follow up the way in which the freedom of religion and belief issue has been highlighted in the new United Nations Human Rights Council Universal Periodic Review of each country, one after another. In this concern, I want to pay tribute to the work of George and Catherine Jarvis. They don't seem to have arrived yet, but they and their interns have done wonderful work with our NGO committees in keeping this issue before governments and before other NGOs. Now, this is a very explicit place where religion is recognized in the UN system, the United Nations High Commission for Human Rights. And given this explicit and long-term recognition by a UN body of the relevance and the need for religious dialogue in promoting peace and justice, a number of religious, interreligious, and value-based NGOs have been emboldened to seek a more permanent forum where the UN can take up issues of cooperation, but also tensions between religions and cultures. At the same time, the UN has been establishing the Alliance of Civilizations. Notice the word civilizations. They didn't dare to call it religions. And UNESCO has been emerging from a long-term taboo to even address the word religion, even in the context of culture. And UNESCO has slowly been sneaking in some references to religion and some programs. The time thus seems propitious to make an intentional bid to connect, to right the issue of specifically interreligious and intercultural dialogue more firmly into the UN agenda. Now, rather than just advocating for a new interreligious advisory commission, a forum, or a program within UN structures, as had been abortively and perhaps impatiently suggested at the Millennium Spiritual Summit some 10 years ago, an idea has emerged of advocating a UN decade for interreligious and intercultural dialogue, understanding and cooperation for peace from 2011 to 2020. In 2010, the existing UN Decade for a Culture of Peace for the Children of the World will formally end. Lessons can be learned that such decades are not just formal or celebratory events, but they should lead to active tripartite cooperation and action between governments, UN agencies, and civil society organizations, including religions. Although we're advocating a UN decade, this is not something that is just to be handed over to a UN agency. This is something where there should be equal possession and partnership by governments, by agencies, UN agencies, and the NGOs. Now, the proposed decade has already been noted in November last year, 2008, in the session of the General Assembly, and a formal resolution has already been passed asking governments to examine the idea of a decade. Those of you who want to have the document can Google UN documentation of the General Assembly, and the reference is A/RES/63/22. And it's in paragraph 8 that there is this explicit mention that governments should be asked to examine the idea of a decade. And as we speak now, the Secretary General is circulating governments with his report on the forthcoming General Assembly. And it's expected that he will refer to the many positive governmental answers which have been received in favour of such a decade. Now, it remains to be seen whether a particular government or a group of governments will then table a new resolution this year to authorise the launching of such a decade in 2011, and thereby provide a framework for enhanced cooperation between governments, UN agencies, and civil society organisations. There are potential and much needed areas of either continuing or new cooperation in the implementation of the Millennium Development Goals, in respect for all human rights, not just the protection of freedom of religion or belief, all human rights being interconnected. Cooperation in humanitarian fields, such as the needs of refugees and migrants, addressing population issues, addressing environmental issues, and the list can go on. Now, so far, I've described diplomatic efforts to achieve the designation of a UN decade. But that's not just a goal in itself. That's not the purpose of making this initiative. Already there are tripartite meetings between governments, agencies, and NGOs, both in New York and Geneva, within which religiously based NGOs play a significant part. But long-term cooperation, rather than competition, needs to be focused on specific areas and possibilities for working together. A day for dialogue or a year for dialogue is not enough. We need a long-term process such as a decade. And the past has shown that such decades can then lead to long-term commitments and structures within the UN. The theme of the last assembly of the Conference of NGOs in consultative status with ECOSOC, the Economic and Social Council, was moving from consultation, our official status, to partnership. And there are already many examples in UN programs, for example, related to refugees, related to population issues, related to humanitarian needs, where such partnership actually already exists with NGOs, including religiously based NGOs. But there are also many other areas of UN work where a more interactive approach with civil society and a more serious and creative, not just consultative relationship, but partnership with NGOs is needed. I remind you that the former Secretary General Kofi Annan kept on telling us that the UN Charter is not in the name of the governments, it's in the name of we the people, and that even the Charter provides participation by civil society. And so it's for civil society partners, not least in academia and in religious and value-based organizations, to demonstrate their credibility and responsibility for critical accompaniment of a wide range of United Nations programs. The proposed decade could be a useful incentive and vehicle for such cooperation and partnership. And even if the time is not seen as ripe by the governments for an official UN decade, I believe there's sufficient energy among like-minded civil society organizations to launch our own decade. I think that would mean lost opportunities, both for the UN and for ourselves. But we don't just depend upon the governments. Accordingly, I say it's desirable that in these very coming months, now in October, soon in November, we do as much lobbying of our governments as is possible, not least in national capitals, to secure that this year's United Nations General Assembly sponsorship and adoption of a resolution in favor of the UN Decade for Interreligious and Intercultural Dialogue, Understanding and Cooperation for Peace will go through and can be achieved 2011 to 2020. How do we do this lobbying? Some academic and religious bodies are not yet accredited, either with the Department of Public Information or with the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. But there's official encouragement, not only for international, but also for regional and national NGOs to apply for such accreditation, and numbers have grown rapidly in recent years. It's true that there's a danger that this generous policy of extension may have allowed admittance of some organizations that are not truly independent of government control, and of some groups that are self-serving rather than dedicated to cooperation. But the great majority of civil society NGOs are independent and are altruistic, as well as often being very practical in their humanitarian and human rights activities. The proposed decade could further encourage groups that are working in isolation or even under oppression to find support and to contribute their achievements. Dialogue, understanding, and cooperation require academic preparation and critique, but these need not be ends in themselves and can lead to transforming actions, overcoming tensions and prejudices, even helping to mitigate conflict and violence. As the UN and its member governments, sometimes belatedly, make explicit recognition of the relevance of religion and culture, both for good and for bad, in building peace and justice, it's vital that the adherents of religions and cultures should themselves demonstrate a readiness to be self-critical about obstructions and oppressions perpetrated in both past and present, often against the very precepts they preach or the values they purport to promote. But as well as self-criticism, we can also be confident and determined to work together, to do better together, what we have so long done separately. In this brief presentation that I have made, I have recounted a number of diplomatic initiatives and a number of ways in which NGOs are supporting and lobbying. But before ending, I want to share some important entry points where we, representing organizations, can make a contribution, whether we're international, regional, or local organizations or religious bodies. Those of us who want to support the idea of a decade have already created a coalition for the initiative for the decade, and some 60 organizations and religious bodies and interreligious bodies are already in this coalition. Nearly 30 of them have made formal engagements. And this is, remember, a very interreligious body. What finance we've used so far has been drawn from at least 8 different religious sources and different religions. It's not just one organization pushing it. It's a very collective effort. We've had these meetings in Geneva and in New York with up to 60 participants from organizations, but also a significant number of governments who have come to observe the meetings, and also representatives of UN agencies. And now, as we speak, with this process going on in New York, preparing possibly a resolution for the General Assembly, the final moment of our preparation is geared to the forthcoming Parliament of the World's Religions in Melbourne at the very beginning of December this year. And we hope that especially if the governments have already made and passed a resolution at the General Assembly, then we in the non-governmental civil society and religious communities can respond immediately by saying, we're on board, we're ready to go with you to launch this organization. And my final word is a sort of appeal to some of you to consider whether your organizations can be part of this. The very final word is to give you the website so that you can look up for yourself for much more detail than I've been able to compress into this 20 minutes. And the website is very easy, www.faithdecadeforpeace, one word, faithdecadeforpeace.net. There you'll have the details, and there you'll have the invitation to make your engagements to be part of this process of connection and cooperation. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I will read my paper in Spanish, because if I read in English, maybe you prefer a horror movie or a session with your dentist. I apologize with that, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning to all of you. I would like to thank the International Center for Law and Religious Studies at Brigham Young University, and I would like to give him a since last May. Okay, so I would like to ask to thank those who have invited us to be here, who have always shown a great deal of respect for institutions in Mexico and their great human beings. And I also want to extend my greetings to all of you with great admiration to you and all of the presenters at this symposium. We only have a few minutes to approach the matter of religious freedom in Mexico, so I will take as my starting point a quote or a relay or a survey of a few key historical events that led to the creation of the Mexican state and our Mexican identity, and I will highlight the religious events. On September 16th of 1810, a Catholic priest called on Mexicans to fight for their independence, and a war started that lasted for 2 years until February 24th, 1821, when Mexico became independent from Spain. Then followed 3 decades of conflicts and infighting between liberal and conservative groups. And the first, meaning the liberals, won, and they created a liberal court in 1857, which redefined the nature of the Mexican state, turning it into a secular state that does not support or promote any religion, endorse or promote a religion. In 1851, President Benito Juarez, from 1859, President Benito Juarez passed the reform laws, which included the nationalization of all goods belonging to the Catholic Church, including real estate such as covenants, churches, monasteries, parish houses. All of those became property of the state. Following that date, and for the next 131 years, no church in Mexico was allowed to own its own property or to own any building. In fact, any building where religious worship was carried by law had to belong to the federal government. In 1910, there was the Mexican Revolution, and a new constitution was implemented, a constitution which is in force until this day. this new constitution gives gives legal personality to religious associations. In 1826, during Plutarco Elias Calles' government, in the entire, the public worship was banned throughout the whole country, which led to a violent episode in our history called the Christ War, or the Cristera War. This ended in 1929, and a sort of status quo was arrived at in Mexico. There were some modifications made to the legal framework, but the authorities did not enforce a lot of the provisions that were meant to restrict the work of religious ministers. This is a period that historians have referred to as the period of falsehood. For instance, the law barred religious monks, nuns, or other religious individuals to be out on the street wearing their religious attire. But nobody, no authority actually enforced this. If anybody went out on the street wearing their religious attire, nobody enforced this law. Mexican presidents at the time never went to any religious events, but in their families they did hold, at times within the president's house, religious events and meetings. Finally, in 1992, 17 years ago, the complex history of the relationship between the Mexican state and the churches came to a tipping point where it was appropriate to amend the constitution or the constitutional framework. That became the period when the religious association entity was created as a civil association with religious traits. This allows the church to have full legal personality. For instance, churches can now purchase real estate in as much as they can afford it and own it. Currently, the Department of the Interior of the Mexican government has 7,174 religious associations, which shows that churches are willing to follow this legal framework. Now, there's not really more than 7,000 religious associations in Mexico, but for instance, there are churches that have a great deal of followers in the country and many meeting houses, but they only have one, they have registered only one or two institutions just because it's convenient for them. Allow me to point out the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Seventh-day Adventists as examples of churches that do this. On the other hand, we have churches that will register a different religious association for every single meeting house or church that they have. For example, let me point the Catholic Church and the Baptist Church as churches that do this. Now, I've dealt a great deal with this religious history, but what it has done is turn the principle of religious autonomy and religious freedom and the principle of judicial equality before the law become institutionalized. In essence, since 1992, Mexico has been able to come to terms with something that it had been unable to do beforehand, meaning the intense religiosity of the Mexican people with the secular history of the Mexican state. Now, everything that I've pointed to up to this point has been the history of the effort to turn Mexico into a country of full religious freedom. But the nature of religious freedom means that we still have a great deal to do. So let me point out three challenges that the government, the churches, and society have to deal with in religious matters. Now, this isn't an exhaustive list, and it doesn't address the very wide gamut of religious matters that need to be addressed in a country that has such a rich religious landscape, meaning a country such as Mexico. First of all, there are important restrictions to religious groups in religious matters, in voting matters, and in telecommunications matter. For example, ministers of religion cannot run for office. Religious associations are legally barred from putting their own TV stations or their own radio stations. There is no set of rules dealing with people who oppose serving in the military due to religious convictions, etc. In other words, and other things, for instance, I am a public servant, so I can't go to any religious event Monday that's held during the work week, during working hours. I would have to ask for leave and take some time off from work in order to attend those religious events. Another challenge has to do with the religious culture of the people. Let me give you an example. Mexico has 10 million Amerindians who do not speak Spanish as their native language. Following the conflict in Chiapas in 1994, there have been several local congresses held with a high percentage of indigenous participants, and they amended their local constitutions to guarantee the preservation of the indigenous traditions. A lot of these Indian communities have their own traditions which go hand in hand. The civil and the religious go hand in hand. For example, they have these patron saints to whom local temples are built. And the way these are celebrated has to do with some very traditional beliefs. Now, the challenges arise whenever you have a family within an indigenous community that decides to change its religion and no longer will pay its due that everyone in the community is expected to pay to carry out the events for that patron saint. So one of the things that these religious communities have done is expelled individuals or entire families from the community when that has happened. So municipal, state, city, state, and federal authorities have had to step in as judges and mediators between the parts to arrive at a nonviolent resolution that will respect human and heritage rights. Another challenge that we have, another case that I'd like to talk to, has to do with the Jehovah's Witnesses. The teenage children will not swear the flag. And the Jehovah's Witnesses promoted or went before a national organization that deals with human rights in Mexico. And what the commission did was issue a recommendation, National Recommendation Number 5, calling upon the Federation of States and Cities to exempt students who were Jehovah's Witnesses from having to swear allegiance to the flag. Both examples show that in Mexico, there are institutional means whereby human rights can be promoted, but we are still lacking some institutional mechanism to promote a culture of tolerance, of religious freedom, of interreligious dialogue, particularly when we're seeing a great deal of growth in religious diversity in Mexico. The third challenge has to do with the difficult situation that Mexico faces when dealing with organized crime and drug dealers. Now, some of you might wonder, what does drug dealing have to do with religious freedom? What happens is when you have an 18-year-old young man who belongs to a very poor family in a marginal community, and he gets recruited by drug dealers and gets paid a salary that he could never otherwise have. And this young man accepts the job knowing that his life will be in risk will be at risk. But what he faces, even if it lasts only a few months, is so much higher, so much better than what he could otherwise have access to. So this is a problem that cannot be dumbed down to a simple policeman versus thieves scheme. So there are a number of religious associations in Mexico, and I've known of a number of them that have very successful social programs that, for instance, deal with the spiritual side of problems such as alcoholism. There are, for instance, practical programs, clinical programs that allow improvement within the family, with communications within the family. So what I'm trying to say here is that whenever we are dealing with nurturing and building character in young people, religious, and especially when dealing with the type of temptations I just described earlier, this goes a lot further than what the government itself can do. The government needs intermediate organizations such as religious associations. And what the government can do is turn that experience from the religious associations into public policy that will allow for the formation of civil principles and values. In essence, the government of Mexico governs for all Mexicans, regardless of what their religious preference might be, whatever their religious association may be, whatever their income or their religious or their sexual orientation may be. The Mexican state realizes that in order for there to be a social and a harmonious social environment, then people need to be allowed to profess their religion and even promote it, because religion satisfies some of the most basic needs that individuals have in order to become fully fulfilled. The Uruguayan poet Mario Benedetti has said, "Utopia pops up in the horizon, and as I approach it, it moves further away." That's what this is about. We need to have a very high goal and never stop moving toward that goal so that we will continue to build worthy societies that are capable of allowing everyone to have their own family, and that every citizen has opportunities for human development. Societies in which we can be productive through honest work, and in which we can look to the future without fear. In essence, we're dealing with societies which will be fair, peaceful, and respectful. Thank you very much.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, my colleagues. First, I would like to express my deep gratitude to Professor Cole Durham and all the people of BYU for such beautiful organizing this meeting and for giving me the opportunity to be among such unique gathering. Today, I'm going to present a piece of work titled by Islam and Religious Freedom, and the role of interreligious dialogue in promoting global peace. And to talk about this title, actually, I'm going to tackle four different parameters. The first parameter will be what is the background of the problem itself, and the second parameter will be the stand of Islam towards religious freedom. And the third parameter will be the role of interreligious dialogue in creating peaceful coexistence among the believers of the different religions. And the last parameter, I will mention the role of Egypt and the efforts of Egypt in the field of interreligious dialogue over the last 20 years on the international level and on the regional and the national level. But before tackling these four parameters, let me start by a piece of the historical speech of President Obama when he came to Egypt last June, on 4th of June, and he gave his historical speech in Cairo University. Actually, he said, the U.S. seeks a new beginning with Muslim communities around the world, based on the shared principles of justice, progress, tolerance, and the dignity of all human beings. Obama also said, it is firm in my belief that the interests we share as human beings are far more powerful than the forces that drive us apart. This message has been mentioned in the historical speech of Obama, actually was mentioned again in the Quran more than 14 centuries ago. God the Almighty said, O mankind, indeed we have created you from male and female and made you people and the tribes that you may know one another. It should therefore become the premises of our gathering to foster peace and eliminate tension and conflicts which dominate many regions of our world, which is supposed to be a place for human civilization. So the message for all of us today is to foster peace and eliminate tension and conflicts. And first, if I want to talk about the background of the problem, all of us agree that after 9/11, a lot of things has happened global-wise. And in the shadow of 9/11, 2001, interest in interfaith dialogue boomed up as an essential tool for bridging the divide in modern societies with multiple identities and the religious pluralism, which is deeply shaped by globalization. Now it is high time for the great majority who are convinced and supporting peaceful coexistence between believers of different faith and beliefs as a cornerstone to global peace and justice to strongly take the initiative for isolating those who are working desperately by all means to keep the road open for fanaticism, extremism, violence, and clashes. But fulfillment of the goal will build up day after day through the practical behaviors of people who belong to different religions, cultures, and civilizations, global-wise, when they conduct dialogue and get to know each other correctly, respecting the privacy of each other, and discover the commonalities which gather them. The above-mentioned goal will be achieved by declarations and the recommendations, but not only by declarations and recommendations. At the elite level, like us here, we are talking and hearing the echo of what we see, of what we say, but primarily through institutional work of the international organizations, the civil societies, and the governments to reach politicians, decision makers, community leaders, and most important, people at the grassroots level, because always the problems come from the grassroots levels and from this age group between 7 years and 18 years and between 18 and 35 years. This is actually the critical age group of creating problems. So we have to take all what we are believe in to the grassroots level. The second parameter is, what is the stand of Islam towards the religious freedom? Is Islam opposed to the religious freedom? The answer is no, and it's very, very big no. And I'm going to mention some evidences that Islam does not oppose religious freedom, but it encourages and accepts religious freedom. And someone might say, you Muslims keep talking about Islam and what happened more than 14 centuries ago. We want to talk about the present time and the future. And I believe in that. I am for the present and the future, and I'm not for the past. But in order to get a good present time and future, successful future, we have to know the past well. That's why we have to encourage people of different religions to know more about their own religions and to know more about the others' religions and to know about history and dig deeply and find out facts. Because most of the conflicts and most of the problems comes from either ignorance of the informations or misuse of the informations or abuse of the informations. So I'll give some evidences that Islam does not oppose the freedom belief. Islam guarantees the freedom of religion. This is verified in the following Quranic verse. Let there be no compulsion in religion. And all the Quranic verses are documented here by the number of the surah and the number of the verse, and you will find it in your documents. The other evidence is then believe that one's freedom to adhere to the religion of one's choice establishes the base of his belief. And this emphasized the following Quranic verse. Let him he will believe, and let him who will reject. No problem. The other evidence, declaring the freedom of belief, means Islam accepting that there is more than one religion. If he declares the freedom of belief, so automatically he Islam accepts the presence of more than one religion. This was stressed by the Prophet Muhammad in the first constitution of the Islamic State in Al-Madinah, when Muhammad moved in Al-Hijrah from Mecca to Al-Madinah and settled down there. He gave the first constitutions for the Islamic State. When he acknowledged Judaism in Al-Madinah and declared that Jews and the Muslims in Al-Madinah formed one nation. The other evidence is an example of Islam granting religious freedom is Umar ibn Khattab. Umar ibn Khattab is one of the companions of Prophet Muhammad. And Umar ibn Khattab treated the Christians of Jerusalem in a fantastic way. He guaranteed the safety of their lives, their churches, and their crosses, assuring them that none of them would be harmed on account of his religion. These are facts documented in history and in religion and in everywhere. Also, Islam grants freedom of thought and opinion, provided that discussions on religion are of an objective nature and are not a pretext for abuse or ridicule. This is stated in the following Quranic verse. Invite all to the way of your Creator with wisdom and beautiful preaching, and argue with them in ways that are best and most gracious. This is the advice of Islam, if I'm going to talk to the others. The other evidence, in the light of this tolerance, discussions may take place between Muslims and non-Muslims. The Quran invites the Muslims to discuss matters with the people of the book. In the following Quranic verse, God the Almighty said, O people of the book, come to common terms. As between us and you, that we worship none but God, that we associate no partners with him, that we elect not from among ourselves lords and patrons other than God. If then they turn back, say, bear witness that we at least are Muslims bowing to the will of God. This verifies that should be the discussion between both parties fail to accomplish its aim. Each person is entitled to adhere to the faith in which he believes. This also was the following Quranic verse expressed concerning the Prophet Muhammad's final remarks to the pagan of Mecca, namely, you have your religion and I have mine. No problem. You have your religion and I have mine. The third important parameter I'm trying to tackle in this presentation actually is the importance of interfaith dialogue in peaceful coexistence between the believers of different religions. And in order to know about that, we have to ask two important questions. How can interreligious dialogue regain trust between the Islamic world and the West? Because the trust between Islamic world and the West has been shaken for so many reasons, it's not the time to talk about it now. And you know most of it. The second question is, how can interreligious dialogue connecting communities of discourse? In order to conduct successful, effective interreligious dialogue, we have to have five important prerequisites for the dialogue to be successful. These five prerequisites are recognition of the other, mutual respect, dialogue between the two parties, tolerance with the other, and the last prerequisite is to join to cooperation between the two parties. But because these five prerequisites are so important, so please allow me to talk about it in some details. If we talk about recognition of the other and the dealing with him on the basis of equality, this is a fundamental prerequisite that cannot be overlooked. Otherwise, would be eliminated and his existence would equal to his non-existence. This is the other. Consequently, there would be no parties each recognizing the other, but there would be only one party, dominating party, giving orders to be obeyed by the other and enforcing its will on that other and rejecting any opposition to its stance, in which case there could be no way to establish trust between the two parties concerned. So the dialogue will fail. The second prerequisite is the mutual respect. The mere recognition of the other is not sufficient. Just to recognize the other is not sufficient. This means that each party should respect the other, his religion, his faith, his belief, his customs, his tradition, and civilization, and the cultural characteristics, and in general, his human rights. This mutual respect is the first true basis for any dialogue or understanding or cooperation between the two parties. It must be taken in consideration here that mutual respect not necessarily means accepting the stance of the other. This is something, and it's not essential to accept the stance of the other, but it means the willingness of every party to listen to the other and to accept in a constructive way his ideas and his criticism too. The third prerequisite for successful interreligious dialogue is dialogue between the two parties. Dialogue between the two parties is the natural outcome of the recognition of the other and the mutual respect. If I recognize the other and I respect him, so automatically I will conduct a dialogue with him. And understanding between the two parties. Through dialogue, each party may understand the other, its stance, its position, its circumstances, its beliefs, and the characteristics of its civilization. Moreover, dialogue eliminates the misunderstanding as well as the preconceived ideas and misconception of each party towards the other. Dialogue likewise makes it possible for both parties to identify common grounds in their civilizations, culture, or history, or the fields that may be utilized for interest of both. The fourth prerequisite is tolerance with the other. Dialogue, as mentioned above, is not an end of itself, but it is a means to achieve tolerance, which in turn promotes cultural exchange, common understanding, and a positive and peaceful coexistence, and consolidates the roots of mutual cooperation in all spheres and at all levels. And the last prerequisite is the joint cooperation. There is no doubt that an atmosphere such as that mentioned above paves the way for establishing the trust and the promoting cooperation between the two parties, a matter which could ultimately lead to the expansion of the scope of cooperation, not only between the two parties, but with others as well, so that all may cooperate in laying down the foundation for peace and stability in the whole world, our common world, and our ultimate goal, which is global peace. The last and fourth parameter of this presentation will be the role of Egypt in promoting interfaith dialogue. And actually, to save time for the ground, I'll cross all this and tackle directly what Egypt has done on the international level regarding interfaith and interreligious dialogue. First, Egypt has made an agreement between Al-Azhar and the Vatican. And very quickly, I mention to you that the Muslim world has three authority bodies. The first authority body is Al-Azhar, Al-Azhar Mosque and University, because in Islam, the mosque is an integrated institute for education too. So now we have Al-Azhar Mosque and Al-Azhar University, where I am a professor of medicine in Al-Azhar University. The second authority body for the whole Muslim world is the Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs, where I am a member and in the Commission of Interfaith Dialogue. And the third authority body is Dar al-Ifta, or the House of Ifta. Ifta is an Arabic word, means to find out the correct Islamic answer for any problem or for any modern issue has been appeared in the recent time by the religious leaders. Something like organ transplantations, something like all these new issues. We have to find out what is the stand of Islam in it. So this is the role of Dar al-Ifta. And it happens that the three authority body, Al-Azhar, Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs, and Dar al-Ifta are in Egypt, in Cairo. Okay? So we had made a treaty between Al-Azhar and the Vatican in year 1998. And we put some rules, and accordingly, there is regular meeting between Al-Azhar and the Vatican quarter a year to discuss the problem between Muslim, Christian, Catholic dialogue. And after fulfilling that treaty, actually, Paul II came to Al-Azhar twice, and he gave speeches, and I would say that a lot of positive attitudes has happened after this treaty. The second treaty we have done is between Al-Azhar and the Church of England, the Church of Canterbury, when The Archbishop of Canterbury was Lord Kerry at that time, and this was in year 2001, and we followed the same regulations which we have done with the Vatican. So we conducted Muslim, Christian, Anglican dialogue with the Church of England. And the main basis of this treaty is to keep the corner of the faith and the corner of the belief not open for discussion. Because if we open discussion in the faith and in the belief, it will be a hell, okay? But because the ethical codes and the common grounds which we are sharing, Muslims and the Christians, are so vast, so we can conduct dialogue in these commonalities. The third activity which Egypt has done, actually, is Egypt hosted Davos twice in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. And when I mention Davos, Davos actually is interested, it is a World Economic Forum, and it is interested only in how to improve the economical status of the world. But what happened actually, after 9/11, we started to talk with the founder of the World Economic Forum, Professor Schwab, and we convinced him that it's so essential to have stability for the success of the economical situation of the whole body. So we implemented a religious parameter along with the World Economic Forum, and we attended the World Economic Forum once in Switzerland in year 2003, and two times hosted in Egypt in Sharm el-Sheikh, and a fourth time in 2002 when the World Economic Forum actually moved to the United States and was held in New York. And 2002 was the era, the peak era of Samuel Huntington talking about the clash of civilizations. And the meeting of World Economic Forum, Davos, in New York at that time, and we made a panel between we Muslims and Samuel Huntington himself, and it was a very, very successful meeting, and things started to change, and the tension of the clash of civilizations started, the plateau started to go down. Also, Egypt. Also, actually, we have done a very good success for things because we believe that we shouldn't keep talking in closed rooms with religious leaders and we hear the echo of each other and that's all. This won't let the dialogue proceed. So, like we did in Davos, a religious parameter along with the World Economic Forum, we did in the Olympiad in 2004. The Olympic Games was held in Athens at that time. And with communication and cooperation with the Orthodox Church, actually, of Alexandria, we went and being hosted in the Olympic Games, and we conducted the dialogue through the Olympic Games, and again, the outcome was very, very positive. This is regarding the activities of Egypt in promoting interreligious dialogue on the international level. On the regional level, actually, in Jordan, there is a very important institution called the Arab Thought Foundation, and it is headed by Prince Al-Hassan Ibn Talal, and they have a very good activities in inter-religious dialogue. So we have communication with this foundation, and we conduct very strong steps in dialogue with the Russian University of Petersburg. So we have a triad, Egypt and Jordan and Russia, through the University of Petersburg, and we proceeded and achieved the success in inter-religious dialogue. Again, on the regional level, actually, Egypt participated with Saudi Arabia in what is known the very famous meeting of Mecca, and this Mecca meeting in inter-religious dialogue was the basis later on. Mecca meeting was in 2008, and then it was the base for the Madrid meeting and the base for the New York meeting about civilization inter-dialogue. And lastly, I will talk about the national level, the activities of Egypt on the national level. And actually, on the national level, it is mainly the Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs. We have our annual
Okay.